The Sisters Perspective is a forum where individuals come to express their viewpoint, their stance, their angle on issues relative to topics of concern to the community globally. Each week, our co-host and featured guest will present a perspective through a unique lens. The Sisters Perspective gives the world a frame of reference, an ear, a voice on politics, public policy, advocacy, finance, economics, health. The Sisters Perspective is a roundtable on hot topics with dialogue on issues in the news. It's a way of looking at controversial subjects, approaches, and outlooks. So come check us out and give us your perspective.
So we want to thank our guests for joining us today. And the occasion calls for each of you to talk about the contributions that you and your organizations are making toward affordable housing. Can you, let's start with you, Camille. Can you talk to our listeners about who you are and the impact you and your organization has made in the realm of affordable housing?
Yes. So I currently serve as you probably mentioned, president and CEO of the Greater Plainfield and Middlesex County Habitat affiliate. And so our model of providing solutions to affordable housing is through home ownership. And so we either build new construction homes or we may even do rehabs. And we provide an opportunity for people to become homeowners by establishing a mortgage that is at an affordable price, taking into consideration their income.
Awesome. And Reverend Johnson, talk to us a little bit about, you know, who you are and the contribution that your affiliations make in the realm of affordable housing.
Yeah, my name is Pastor A.J. Johnson. And I am the senior pastor of a small but mighty church in Hartford, Connecticut, based in the 06120, which is designated as the Promise Zone. I ain't seen none of the promises yet, but it's a federal designation, being that we are one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. And the Promise Zone allows tax incentives and tax credits for affordable housing and whatnot. And the neighborhood has not been where my church sits ever since 1967, when the riots went around when Dr. King died. There were riots that happened that destabilized the neighborhood. There was white flight. Businesses never recovered. The housing market decreased, and it became an African-American neighborhood. And it being an African-American neighborhood, there were no development. And so the organization that I work for, the Christian Activities Council, started doing putting up affordable housing in the neighborhood. And then in 2008, when the market crashed, the kind of programming for it kind of tanked too. And so we've had the opportunity to kind of rebrand and rethink our mission. And so we went to a mission of community organizing. The organization hired me as a organizer because of my local ties in the community and, you know, my spirit of excellency in getting things done. And so when they hired me, I went into my neighborhood and started looking for issues. And long story short, I'm sure we'll get into the housing stuff. Long story short, almost 2.5 years later, we have won several big issues in our community, mm-hmm. one being transportation for students, mm-hmm. The other keeping a community school open that was slated to close. And of course, the biggest thing that we've done that's gotten national attention is the is us taking on slumlords and creating a campaign called No More Slumlords.
Awesome. That's great. Can you talk about some of the, and you just mentioned about no more slumlords. Can you talk about some of those new affordable, it sounds like an affordable housing solution that has worked, that is working very well for you. Can you talk a little bit more about that program, as well as anything else that Christian organizations is doing?
All right, so we don't necessarily have a program. We are community, so again, my job as a community organizer is to go into the neighborhood and listen to issues, meet people, find potential leadership. What we found out is that in most of poor, impoverished neighborhoods, there's a leadership vacuum. What most neighborhoods have are gatekeepers. And those gatekeepers keep all of the power, and it limits the ability of the potential of some of our neighborhoods. In essence, some are the Democratic parties in small impoverished neighborhoods. It could be small local groups. It could be just small groups of power that doesn't allow residents and people in those spaces to become experts on issues that they live. So, okay. When we encountered the housing issue, a mom at a school where I was helping these parents create a PTO organization, a mom came to me and said, "Pastor AJ, there's a woman and a child in our school who keeps getting bit by mice, and she's coming to school with these mice bites. Can you go and see about her? Can you go see what, you know?" So I call the mom, and as a community organizer, I'm so used to people missing meetings. Most of my day is meeting people. And sometimes people miss meetings and don't say anything. So I asked this lady to keep the meeting. I said, "I'll be there Friday at this time, keep the meeting." And lo and behold, Friday came. I went to her house, knocked on her door, and she wasn't there. And I called her and said, "Ma'am, I told you to make this meeting. You know, my day is very, you know, packed with different things. And if I make time, you know, please be respectful and call." This lady said, "I'm so sorry," in her broken English. This is a Spanish lady with five kids living in a project-based building, project-based subsidy building in North Hartford. She said, "Pastor AJ, I'm sorry. I couldn't be there. My daughter ingested mice poison this morning, and they rushed her to St. Francis Hospital, and I'm here." So I immediately say, "I'll be there." And as I go to her, go to the ER, she's walking out, and there's two DCF workers, meaning Department of Children and Family Workers, trying to remove her five children. I asked the DCF workers to kind of fall back, allow me an opportunity to talk to her. And as she's talking to me, she's crying. And she said, "Pastor AJ, I have mice in my apartment. I catch 30 mice a day in my apartment. The landlord only drops off sticky traps, or the management company only drops off sticky traps. They never do anything to fix the problem. I went out to the dollar store, got me some mice poison. Unfortunately, my daughter got up. I have five kids, got up before me, went to the mice poison, ingested it. Now these people are trying to remove my children." I said all that to say, when I went back, I was so mad about this. I went back and knocked on all those doors in her building. I realized that these people were dealing with deplorable conditions. I then looked at the landlord, found out that the landlord is a slumlord out of New York City who makes over $2 million in Connecticut in federal subsidies. And then we started out organizing, but I'll end there just to take care
of it. And I was only going to say that as a community organizer, the work that community organizers do, especially in this realm, is, I mean, I would consider it to be a solution. Because we all have to start somewhere. Camille Williams, talk to us. I mean, Habitat for Humanity has been around now for a little better than 40 years. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, what your affiliate does and, you know, what contributions you guys are making to affordable housing?
Yes. Yeah, so our affiliate is actually 30 years old. So we are, awesome. You know, kind of truly among some of the oldest affiliates across the country. Awesome. And in that time, we've built 50 homes, and we started out, it's so funny, Reverend Johnson, you said you have a small but mighty church. That's actually what I say about our affiliate, is that we are a small but mighty affiliate. We started out in the greater Plainfield area, and, you know, just Plainfield is kind of called the Queen City. That's a lot of historical relevance to the state of New Jersey, beautiful, big colonial homes. And however, it has become an urban city over time, I guess. And so we now have an administration that is really working very hard to bring that back. And we're excited to be part of that. But Plainfield has kind of always been, for probably the past 20 to 30 years, has been this city that was declining, same kind of thing due to urban flight to the suburbs that surround Plainfield. And so we've been building homes, you know, just trying to maintain stability in the city of Plainfield. And so we've done that very successfully. And in 3 years ago, we were merged with another affiliate that was not very active at the time, and that included Middlesex County. And so that has really grown our service area, although our staff capacity still reflects a small affiliate. And so so that's 2 years ago I came on board, and I have really focused very hard on, you know, just building the brand and letting the community know that we're here, and just doing a lot of work in relationship building so that, you know, we can grow our capacity to be able to serve and to build more homes. And right now we have three houses that we're currently working on, which is a lot for an affiliate our size. We're, you know, kind of adding some staff now currently to try to manage that growth. But right now we have a house under construction that we're completing in Plainfield. And we have another one in Avenel, which is in Middlesex County, which is a rehab. And then we have another new construction home in Perth Amboy that we just started this year and hope to finish that by early next year. And so, you know, our contribution, like I said, is affordable, providing a home through, you know, and home ownership through creating an affordable mortgage based on the family's incomes. In New Jersey, you know, we have a real critical issue here, which is affordable housing. And it has been that way for many years. And I think now we're kind of at the, you know, at the time where this has become a hot topic of conversation.
Yes, absolutely.
There's been legislation that has been passed, but now actually within the past few years is being enforced, which are these suburban towns, making them maintain their affordable housing obligation and not passing it off to the urban cities like Plainfield, like Newark, and some of the other urban cities, but actually forcing them to provide that affordable housing within their suburban towns. And needless to say, that has been a big hot topic of much dissension on both sides, I would say. But, you know, our governor has been committed to, you know, working with affordable housing advocates to, you know, kind of make sure that this is fair and, you know, giving us the support that we need through legislation. So we're excited about that. But in addition to providing the home ownership, you know, we also work with other organizations by, you know, providing opportunities for homeowner education and connecting with banks, you know, in order to give a platform for them to give out this information, so that even if people are not able to take advantage of the Habitat opportunity, there's still opportunities that are out there that people can become homeowners, and it can be a situation that you know, they can afford. And the banks have, you know, thank God, they've done a lot of work on revamping some of their mortgage laws, you know, because it wasn't always that way. Unfortunately, the poorest of our communities were being taken advantage of with these mortgage packages that, you know, in the end forced them to lose their homes for the most part. So, you know, there's been a lot of work from the financial institutions to create a program that truly is honoring, you know, affordable home ownership.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, we've partnered with banks to try. Yeah, just that we partner with banks to try to make, you know, give them a platform in our communities.
Yeah. Now that I consider that to be a solution also, that those partnerships that as an affiliate, you know, it's more than just about providing housing, but, you know, other opportunities. If they can't, like you said, if they can't take advantage of what Habitat has to offer, then there are other opportunities for them to position themselves in such a way that they can. And you've both spoken about the challenges, some of the challenges, especially Reverend Johnson, in the realm of housing. We know that gentrification is definitely a hot topic. So given that, I want to pull some of both of your opinions on the impact of poverty, that poverty has on the affordable housing or the lack thereof. And what role does poverty play for those who will be, I hate to use the word victimized by gentrification, but who will be affected by gentrification in your communities? Why don't you start out, Camille, and just kind of, you know, kind of talk about that, about the impact of poverty.
Right. So, I mean, we're seeing locally in Plainfield, also in Newark, which is not far away from where we are, you know, there's this, you know, surge of gentrification. And I believe what that ultimately is going to lead to is overcrowding in some of the other urban cities. And so therefore, affordable housing, you know, will be in such demand that these surrounding cities will not be able to compensate for that. And I believe that's going to lead to an increased incidence of homelessness, quite frankly. I do, you know, I believe that if we look at certain cities like Baltimore and Washington, D.C., there are certain, you know, these are areas that are having Atlanta record amounts of homelessness within, you know, kind of as an aftershock effect of gentrification, because right outside of the urban area is a suburb, and the suburbs are not, they don't have the capacity to take that overflow. Their homes have very high prices. Many of the suburbs don't offer apartments or rental opportunities. And then, like I said before, some of the other urban areas that sit, you know, kind of around the areas that are going through gentrification, you know, they're at capacity with their, you know, with vacants, you know, with vacant opportunities for people to move into. So I do believe that if we look at some of these other cities, we can see how, you know, right after gentrification becomes this high incidence of homelessness. And it's not just, you know, your adult male or adult single woman, but these are families that are living in cars and, you know, and sleeping on, you know, on people's couches and so forth. Like it's, you know, so I do believe that that is something that unfortunately we're going to see, and no one is planning for, as you know, some of these urban areas are so excited about to some degree being gentrified, because that means businesses start coming in, and, you know, which leads to revenue for the city. People with higher income start coming in, and so that leads to more money being spent locally. And, you know, so it doesn't have to be all bad, but there's no plan.
Well, I have a question about that. So as the CEO of a Habitat affiliate, how as gentrification comes in, and we know we talk all the time about the level of dislocation that happens as a result of gentrification. How much availability or how committed do you think city planners will be in providing affordable housing within the realm of that gentrification, within the community that's being gentrified? Because, you know, we want the businesses to come in, we want to clean up the neighborhoods, but within that, shouldn't there be a certain level of a certain amount of affordable housing as well?
I mean, I definitely believe that there should be. I just think, just what you said, I think there really isn't a plan. And, you know, and what, you know, the folks that are coming in to these neighborhoods, they're basically taking properties that at one point would have been, let's say, rental, you know, people would have been renting them out for an affordable mortgage, affordable rent, you know, but they're coming in and they're buying these homes and either tearing them down or, you know, they're rehabbing them. I don't think that city planners are saying, okay, so if we know that we're going to lose X amount of, you know, of units, we have to find them somewhere else. No, everyone's using the same model of, we have new development coming in. I have a developer that wants to build a luxury apartment of 300 units. And, you know, they're going to give me 20% at an affordable rate. Well, but the space that they took up got rid of more than 20 units. You know what I mean? Or 30
right,
units.
Right. And so given that, is there an opportunity for an affiliate like yourself, a Habitat for an affiliate, to go into that community and say, or to talk to city planners and say, hey, we know you have this developer coming in, but can we purchase, can we have an opportunity? I'm not really clear on how that works, but can we purchase some of that property and some of those so that we can provide persons with an opportunity? You say what?
Well, hold on. This is where the community organizers come in. But I'll
okay.
I'll answer this question. No, go ahead. I want to hear you.
Well, and I think that you're right. And that's where we, you know, we as affiliates, you know, try to be part of that conversation and make sure that, you know, we're in that conversation. And as you know, Reverend Johnston, sometimes those conversations are happening and nobody knows about those conversations.
Correct.
Right. And so, you know, but for us, you know, we do try to be part of those conversations. And you know, some towns are excited about having Habitat there and, you know, try to make it as, I guess, the access there for us to be able to, you know, to get land or to get some of these abandoned properties. But when gentrification is rolling, these properties are now expensive and they're not necessarily owned by the city, or the city has a real decision to make. You know, do I sell this lot to this developer for $500,000 or do I make it available to a Habitat for maybe $50,000? Because we cannot compete with, you know, with that kind of sales price. And so what we're finding, you know, in some areas is, and this is starting to happen in Plainfield a little bit, is, you know, land is becoming at a premium. Open lots are not as plentiful as they once were. And so the ones that are there, or that, you know, maybe the city is making available because, you know, things are being torn down, they can be made available to us, you know, for the nice sum of some amount that is beyond what a Habitat can afford.
Gotcha. Okay. You say what, Reverend Johnson?
Yeah. So this conversation is very, very interesting because I think Camille has it. She's done a great job explaining the process, explaining it in such a way from like a programmatic, like institutional side. And I think where we connect and kind of where we differ is the people who live in these spaces. Like, you know, I consider myself a content professional on people who live in Habitat homes or live in Section 8 housing. And the disconnect is that when housing is put up, there's something called a planning and zoning entity that each municipality has that dictates what can go where and how mm-hmm. it could be set up and what it will look, you know, that planning and zoning mm-hmm. commission is something where when we organize through these different spaces. And so right. in Hartford, as I stated, Hartford is kind of set up like any urban space, right? You have your suburbs, which, as Camille stated, you know, the wealth, the income, you know, the wealth disparity gap is ridiculous. In Hartford, the average person makes $13,000 a year. And in the most wealthiest suburb in Connecticut, that gap goes until like $250,000 a year. And so when wow. we pulled a HAP contract due to deplorable conditions, and I wish I could kind of go through how that happened, because when we talk about deplorable conditions, we talk about people who live in these conditions who have no choice but to live there due to a federal contract that is a 20-year contract, and there is no accountability from license and inspection up into the REAC inspections, up into, you know, maintenance handling the day-to-day issues, and people live in deplorable conditions. But once that contract is pulled, people, the families that were living in those units, this became a big issue. It's like, where do you want to move? And most of them said, well, I want to move out of Hartford. And it's, you know, it's choice. Wherever you want to go, cool. But then I begin to ask the question, you know, why do you want to move out of Hartford? Well, it's the violence. I've been here for 20 years. And what people don't know about these HAP contracts and project-based housing is that, you know, it's kind of the new form of slavery. It's kind of the new form of Jim Crow. It's kind of the new form of that, because once people are in these contracts or living in project-based housing, you can't go anywhere, because the subsidy stays with the unit, right? And so being that the subsidy stays with the unit, if a person wants to go because their apartment is bad, the question is, where are they going to go? Most of, and Camille can probably speak to this with her local housing authority, there are no more affordable units in urban settings. So people either, one, become couch surfers, homeless, two, you know, the second option is they have to stay where they are in those conditions. So once this contract is pulled, it kind of gives them choice to go where they want to go. But what we've seen is that, one, as was stated earlier in our conversation, is that there is no affordable housing in suburbs. There are very few multi-unit dwelling spaces in suburban neighborhoods. So that only allows people to move in segregated spaces that were designated segregated spaces, which is kind of hard, because in Hartford at one time, almost 60% of our housing in Hartford was low affordable income housing. And some people would say that's great. But then on the other hand, that's what we call segregation. Mm-hmm. When you only put these affordable units in certain spaces and then call it bad. That's what mm-hmm. happens in our community when suburban folks can watch TV and look at Hartford as a bad place, but they don't have any affordable housing, nor have any neighbors that, you know, have any neighbors that are people of color, right? And mm-hmm. so what we've done through the community organizing is have residents at the table and push the issue of affordable housing in suburban neighborhoods. And it's funny, because when I ever since I've started on this housing thing, this housing issue, I've realized that most of the towns, we have 169 towns in Connecticut. And most of the towns, they're planning and zoning, when affordable housing comes up on their docket and they're planning and zoning, it always loses. They do not want people of color in those spaces. And I applaud the work that New Jersey is doing. I'm actually happy to hear that. Here in Connecticut, we've started on a local level just by dealing with the housing code. Let's first of all deal with the housing code. Then let's deal with the planning and zoning. Then let's talk to HUD and figure out why they're only funding low-income housing with millions of taxpayer dollars in these neighborhoods. So these are the questions that most people need to ask. Is why are our tax dollars only being spent with project-based housing in poor neighborhoods? Why can't these developments go in more pristine neighborhoods?
Right.
Well,
right.
I would ask the question. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Camille.
No, well, I really appreciate you talking about that, like how those old, very familiar forms of oppression, Jim Crow, segregation, how they seem to manifest themselves in these new forms that almost like kind of go under the radar to a certain point, like mass incarceration, as you were saying, this new form of segregation. So, like, thank you so much for speaking about that. That was very well said. And, you know, I spoke to you guys before. My name is Paula Granston. I'm a public health student. I'm a rising senior now, and I'm looking to go into healthcare access. And Reverend Al, everything you just said, and Ms. Camille, everything you guys have said has been so informative, so convicting. But specifically, that story that you shared about that Hispanic woman with 5 kids that, you know, had her house infested with mice, that was very heart-wrenching to hear. And it really calls to mind the inseparable relationship that housing and health has. So with that in mind, I wanted to ask both of you, how does people's access to affordable housing affect their personal health and public health as a whole?
Oh, man. If you don't mind, Camille, I would love to answer this question.
That's perfect. Because, that's perfect. Come on, Reverend Al.
Yeah. And it's AJ, Reverend AJ Johnson. You know, it's really, really interesting because when we go into homes, and I've had the opportunity to be in a lot of apartments, I've seen mold, I've seen mold flowers growing on people's bathrooms, I've seen mold in kids' rooms, I've seen mice, feces in infant male milk, I've seen plumbing not working. I've seen holes in people's ceilings with asbestos and all kind of things coming out. And when we look at our enforcement tools to help make the person's situation better, all of our enforcement tools, I can't say this for every state, but I'm just talking about Hartford, Connecticut. When I looked in our Chapter 18 and our housing code, and I looked in to what the public health department can do locally, what I found out is most of this stuff is 40 years old. When we look at some of the tools of enforcement and the teeth that we can use to make these conditions better health-wise, I mean, we have children going to school. We wonder why in Hartford we have one of the worst education systems and why children are performing terribly. Well, one is because we're flat funding education. But the second part is where these children live don't produce opportunities for learning, because if I got to go to school and fall asleep in school because there's mice running a race on my bed, you know what I mean, at night, and I'm terrified and I wake up and go to school and that's the safest place I can go. These are health issues. And what I found is that most of the time, when we looked at the stuff that causes for enforcement that we can use to help make situations better, they're old and outdated and they're not current. And nor can the cities or municipalities afford to enforce the stuff that they have on their books. And so it is a big public health issue when you have people living in these conditions. I've knocked on over 1,000 doors, 1,000 plus doors in my neighborhood. And I can say that 95% of the houses and apartments that I knocked on, those children have respiratory infections. Wow. I have a woman who has documentation, of her newborn baby coming home, leaving the hospital healthy. And 5 years later, we have documentation of every month And every week she brought her child to the doctor's office. And the doctor clearly stated in his paperwork that the health of the child has declined due to the apartment that they're living in. Remove this family from this apartment and no action has happened. So this is a major public health crisis.
Right.
With our Black and brown children living in these conditions. And a lot of my work is getting them the tools to say something about it. A lot of my work is listening to their stories and putting their stories in public spaces and creating the agitation. But most of the time, there are people in these cities, probably where you are right now, that are quietly going through these things and need help dramatically because their children are living with conditions that are unacceptable.
Right. Right. Well, thank you so much for that. That was amazing, just like the way that you broke that down. And in school, I feel like I hear about these housing crises, but I hear about it from such a, it doesn't really have a human element to it. It's very, it's an academic environment, obviously, so it's going to be more objective than other environments, but it's kind of unfeeling. It's more, it's not the same, like hearing from someone who's really seen it firsthand. And obviously you're very passionate about this. And every single person that you come in contact with in this whole realm of affordable housing, they're very lucky to have you and to meet you, because it's very clear that you're passionate about this and that you really want to affect real change. So I really thank you so much for that.
No, really,
the work that you're doing is amazing. And these kids, these adults, everyone in between, they don't deserve to be living in these conditions, but unfortunately that's the world we live in. But we have people like you and Ms. Camille who are trying to, you know, really change these systems that have been so ingrained in our society, so ingrained in our country. And so I really appreciate that. And Ms. Camille, I also wanted to ask you, how do you think that people's access to affordable housing affects their personal health and public health as a whole?
Well, I think Reverend AJ really articulated very well from a physical standpoint. The only thing I would add to that is to address, you know, the mental health capacity, right? The stress that mom he spoke of, right? The stress that she had been under for however long as her children probably were being bit. And then particularly that day that she woke up and found that her child had ingested that poison. Right. And then on top of all of that, you know, DCF trying to remove the rest of her children. Like, you know, there's a constant state of stress that people who live in poverty live in, that people who don't have absolutely no idea. And that is something that very often, I mean, although I've only been at Habitat for 2 years, going into my third now, I've worked in the field of nonprofit service delivery in the hunger field. And so again, that involves, you know, fighting poverty as well. And so the reason why people don't have enough to eat, or they, you know, don't have safe, decent housing, is because they are poor. I mean, that's really the root, is poverty. And so the mental stress that people who live in poverty, I mean, we all have stress at different levels, but sometimes I have to explain to funders or board members, you know, what the people that we serve deal with day to day. And they are these decisions of, you know, do I keep my lights on or do I buy food? And sometimes it's at the raw part of that, you know, do I buy my child's asthma medicine or do I make sure that there's food for tomorrow's breakfast? Like, these are some decisions that people who have means, like when you really sit and talk with them and you explain it, their brains almost don't want to believe it, because it is so absurd to their way of life to even consider having to make these types of choices. You know, just the stress of, you know, I can't afford aftercare for my child, so my six-year-old is coming home by themselves and in the house until I get home 2 to 3 hours later? And are they safe during that time? I mean, there are some real issues that, you know, that these folks are dealing with on a daily basis that causes, you know, a mental stress that then, as we know, affects their physical health. Right. And so, so that's where then now you're dealing with depression, you're dealing with anxiety. Right. And so with that, how do you cope? How do you cope? Well, I can't really afford the copay if I have insurance. Can I afford the copay to go see a therapist? I'm just making ends meet to pay the copay, whatever that may be, for my child to go to the doctor. So I may not have the money to have a, to pay a therapist to have someone to speak to. And so then that, you know, so then the coping of dealing with that stress, now that may play out in some other ways. Which is why you will have a high incidence of alcohol or drug abuse in poor communities. Now, they're not, we all know and are now accepting that they're not just isolated to to poor communities, but you certainly do have that there because you there's you have to cope with stress. And many times, you know, these folks are living in and growing up in conditions where they have not figured out another way to deal with that stress. And that stress is real. It keeps them up at night. It doesn't let them sleep through the night. It's very real. I mean, think about when you go through your own stressful situation, you might not sleep well at night, but it may not be due to necessarily money, or even it, even if it is about money, sometimes it's a short-term situation. This is chronic and it's their everyday life.
Can I want to add to that. So when you said keep what, you know, what keeps them up at night, that's one of the first questions I ask when I meet a resident, when I meet someone that I'm beginning to organize, is what keeps them up at night. And and if that question doesn't get them going, you know, I ask them, you know, what, you know, what's your vision for your children, you know? And most of everyone we meet have the same thing, that they want to make a better situation for their children. And one statistic that I didn't mention is that all the doors that most of the doors that I knock on in public housing is the same way, is like almost 89 and 90% asthma in those cases. Most of them are about 90% women of color, you know, women of color who have several children trying to make ends meet. And the stereotypical attitude of people living in affordable housing or low income housing or the projects, however you want to identify it, is that these are lazy people who don't work and they want a handout. And my experience, I've seen some of the most hardest working women I've ever seen in my life in these spaces.
Yes, sir.
Hardest working, they work two jobs. They come home, prepare food, pick their kids up, get their kids ready for dinner, get ready for the next day. And the problem that I've seen, and that makes me very, very upset when I think of how people view, how the suburbs, because again, I can only talk for Connecticut. Connecticut was once the richest state with the poorest capital. Connecticut, there's millionaires that live 5 miles away from, less than 5 miles away from the worst part of the space. And we're still talking about poverty, right? When I go in and, you know, we get news coverage, the thing that I tell the residents and I empathize with them is that it is so sad that we have to fight for our dignity. We have to prove our dignity. Do you know what it is to prove your dignity and prove that you are a decent person to viewers all across the state who think that you are a person just receiving a handout, or you, like, people have to prove their dignity. So on top of that mental health component, on top of that health component, it's like we're fight, we're all, like, it seems like we're fighting just to get to zero. And then to prove that we deserve to be at zero, only to try to get to 10. And 10 is what we deserve anyway in this country. And so there's a narrative And, you know, so what we, you know, a solution just to move forward, because I got to go in a minute, but a solution that we have worked, that we're working on, is working with churches to help churches, not just Black churches, but white churches, different denominations, come in and understand what this is, helping them see, because I believe that the church is the barking dog in the community, and the church has just been really, really quiet lately on some issues. We've gotten these grants, these federal grants. We've got that No Child Left Behind money. We got that CDC money, you know, and we be real quiet, right? But, you know, the church once was a space where it stood for justice. And there's, when I go into a church and explain this, I explain this in two ways. There's a difference between charity and justice. Charity is what you do for somebody, right? Justice, there's 2 feet to the church. Charity is what you do. Jesus said, if you love me, feed my sheep. But he also said, in Micah, walk humbly and love justice, you know, love justice and do justice, right? And that's the part that we miss, is the justice piece. We've got so comfortable in charity, maintaining these systems of charity, to where we never really fight for justice. We never really fight for the people who come into our churches who live in these situations.
I love what you're saying, Reverend Johnson. And once, and to add, I want to just add to that, and I'm trying not to do a whole lot of talking because I love what you guys are saying. That I want to add to that is part of the mission of the church is that we talk about that charity piece, but the Black church in particular, the African American church, has historically been a place for social justice. And it's unfortunate that that aspect of the church, I think, may have died with Dr. King. But the church does need to come out of their comfort zone in that charity piece. And I love the scriptures that you we were going to touch a little bit on the theological aspect of it. And I love that what you said about that. I love the scriptures that you've offered. And I don't want to, we can go on and on with this conversation, but I love what you guys have said so far. And I only want to add that when we talk about poverty, there are two types of poverty that we talk about in academic and theological circles. And that's that situational poverty. And that's that chronic poverty that Camille spoke about earlier. And it's unfortunate that that there's a notion in the realm of affordable housing, and we talk about poverty, there is a notion that the only way out of that generational poverty, the only way that people have out of that generational poverty or that chronic poverty is two ways. Either they have a sponsor or they have to have a plan. And when we talk about addressing the issue of affordable housing and really getting to the root of it, as Camille talked about, we have to look at poverty and its impact, not just so much on the gentrification part, because we know that's going to happen, but we have to address the issues that bring poverty into play. And we have to address it holistically. It's not just about getting HUD to give us some money. It's not about just the city saying we're gonna put this part of town. We're gonna make sure that 20% of what they're building is affordable housing. But we have to address those mental, those spiritual issues. We have to address food insecurity. I mean, we've got to address the entire gamut of issues that manifest themselves as a result of poverty that lead to this lack, or that I'm sorry, that affordable housing just kind of adds to that. Camille, can you offer any final words before we sign off? Because I just want to thank both of you for sitting in with us today. Paula and I are really we're advocating for affordable housing. We're advocating for the impact on public health. And do you guys have any final words, like, you know, if for those who may be standing, who may be listening, who are in need of affordable housing, you know, what are your final words of wisdom from both of you? Camille?
Ooh, so thank you for the opportunity to have us engage in this conversation. And Reverend Absolutely. AJ, it's been a pleasure to talk with you and to meet you for the first time. And God bless you and your efforts in your community. And, you know, I guess what final thoughts I would say is that, you know, for folks that are listening and, you know, there's something churning in them that's troublesome about the conversation that we're having, you know, find out who is moving, you know, in the space, in these spaces, in your local mm-hmm. community, and just mm-hmm. pick up the phone and say, you know, I care and I want to know how I can help. And, you know, and interestingly enough, there was a woman at a meeting about a year and a half ago who, you know, I was at a community meeting and of affordable housing, you know, advocates, you know, organizations in the space. And she introduced herself. She said, you know, I'm just an individual, but I care about this. And it bothers me that, you know, I live in this city and I'm seeing what's happening. And I found out about this meeting and I just want to figure out how I can help. And, you know, lo and behold, over time, she you know, became an intern at one of the organizations that was at that table. And she is now professionally moving in that space. And so, you know, we have room for volunteers and people who care because we can't be everywhere and we can't be part of every conversation that's happening. But, you know, but there is a place that, you know, in everyday individuals can pick up the phone and give us a call and find out how they can work with us and support us in what we're doing.
Awesome. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me on this call. And I really want to get with that sister from Jersey just to hear some of the stuff that they've got going on because, you know, a lot of this work is cool during the organizing, but, you know, now we're moving into the policy piece and mm-hmm. policy is important. My final words would be, this. In this country, power comes in two forms: organized money and organized people. And I know in our communities that if you know, most of us don't have the last name Trump or Hilton or you know, or Hines or any of the great white names sure. that have made a lot of money, Bloomberg, you know, across this country. Right. We might not right. have the financial stability to play in the power game that way. But what we do have is organized people. And what has been proven in this country is that organized people has changed a lot in this country. So my final words would be to organize around these issues. Create a voice. Magnify it. You have to magnify these issues. Because this world will continue to go on the way it is if they don't see what people are experiencing and what they're going through. The final story, because I am a preacher, I'm going to preach hard right here. The final thing right. that I would say as a final word is a story of a guy fishing at this riverbank. And as he's fishing at this riverbank, he looks down the river and he sees a baby floating down the river. I'm sure you've heard this story 20 times. And this baby's coming down the river. He jumps in the river. He saves the baby. He calls his friend and says, "Hey, man, this baby, I found this baby in the river. Can you please come bring food?" His friend comes down to the river and brings food. The guy goes back fishing. And as he continues to fish, he sees three more babies coming down the river. He jumps in the river, saves these three babies, comes back to the bank where he was fishing, and calls three friends and says, "Can you bring Pampers to the riverbank? These babies need Pampers." Three friends come down, brings Pampers. He goes back fishing. And as he's fishing, another 10 babies come down the river. He jumps in the water, saves these 10 babies, goes back to the riverbank, and says to calls his other friends and said, we need education down here for these babies. Friends come down, set up a little school on the bank. Finally, a black woman by the name of Camilla comes to the bank and looks around and asks the question of these men. And she asks the question, has anybody gone upriver to see where these babies are coming from? Has anybody gone upriver to see why they're throwing these babies in the river and why they're doing this injustice? And all of our missions of our organizations and all of our nonprofits and all of our institutions and our urban neighborhoods needs to be not maintaining the bank. What I mean by maintaining the bank is providing services, but never really going upriver to see why we need food in a country that's so rich, mm-hmm. why we need housing in a country that is so rich, why we need healthcare and affordable that's so rich. So my final word is to not be comfortable maintaining these issues of poverty, but going upriver and seeing why and addressing these issues at the root cause of it. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you both for your contributions and being on this call. We are eternally grateful for what you're doing. Keep doing what you do in your communities to make it better, not just for affordable housing, but for all other aspects of just good living. And just remember that God is watching. He's watching both sides. He's watching us, and he's watching, quote unquote, them, if you know what I mean.
As a professional in ministry, the sister's perspective assumes the right to voice an opinion on the topics discussed in this podcast relative to the church. Reverend AJ presented a great word about the spiritual importance of housing, and I am reminded of Isaiah's prophecy in the 32nd chapter about the cultural shifts in Jerusalem when he says, my people will live in peaceful dwellings, in secure homes, in undisturbed places of rest. My question I direct to all church leaders, pastors, bishops, and all who dare to shepherd congregations. Is it not the mission of the church to minister to the social, spiritual, and physical development of all people? Can we see generational and situational poverty as root ailments presenting themselves in the form of housing insecurity? Well, if so, then should not the church make the issue of affordable housing an agenda priority? So that in keeping with the mission of the universal church, which is to minister to the social, spiritual, and physical development of all people, that our people can live in peaceful dwellings, in secure homes, and in undisturbed places of rest. This is Lara Lane White bringing you the Sister's Perspective. Thank you all for listening. A special thanks to KESA Public Radio. And for more information, you can check out our website at www.thesistersperspective.com. And as I leave you, please remember the famous words from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. So long, everyone.
The Sister's Perspective is a forum where individuals come to express their viewpoint, their stance, their angle on issues relative to topics of concern to the community globally. Each week, our co-host and featured guest will present a perspective through a unique lens. The Sister's Perspective gives the world a frame of reference, an ear, a voice on politics, public policy, advocacy, finance, economics, health. The Sister's Perspective is a roundtable on hot topics with dialogue on issues in the news. It's a way of looking at controversial subjects, approaches, and outlooks. So come check us out and give us your perspective.